are listening to Radio Albion. Hello everybody and good evening and welcome to tonight's stream. We are live tonight on Rumble and Odyssey. Please share those links. Now, it's going to be a particularly interesting stream tonight. Well, I think it is anyway, because I intend to do something that I haven't seen anyone else do yet. I've actually got a link to the judge's sentencing remarks from the Henry Novak murder case. And we're going to go through them and do an analysis of them tonight live on stream. Then we're going to compare what was said in the sentencing remarks with what Kemi Badenoch's been saying. And we're going to find out why she's misleading the public. And we're going to come to quite an interesting conclusion. But before we do all that, I just want to say, please do check out my other work. I had an excellent episode of Patriotic Weekly Review earlier this week with Nativist Concern. Check that out. That was 2 hours long. I also have a new Substack article up today, and that's called Henry Novak's Killer's Lenient Sentence. And that is something, I think I've got the name wrong there. I didn't call it something that awkward. I'll have to look it up. Oh, that's not a good start, is it, guys? Either way, I've got a new Substack article up. It's a really in-depth article. It's about 5,000 words long, and it's called Henry Novak's Killer Receives a Lenient Sentence. That's what it's called. Now, the links are in the pinned comments if you're there watching on either Rumble or Odyssey. So click those and you'll be taken straight to my Substack and that particular article. Please, please do check out my Substack. Go and subscribe to me. And also, if you like, become a regular contributor there. It's very, very affordable. It helps me out a great deal. And this article is a really good article. It's very, very shareable. And it's something that you could share with your family. They will understand what's written in the article. And it's not something which is edgy. It's not something on a site that's out of the ordinary. It's something that I think most normal people could read and enjoy. So please go and check out that Substack article. Now, also, as I said, share the link for this stream. And if you can, consider making a donation. This stream is obviously live tonight. And I get by people's generosity. So if you like the stream, if you want to contribute to the stream, if you have something to say, send a super chat. I will note down all the super chats and I'll read them out in the second hour of the show. It'll be about an hour long presentation and then we'll get to any questions. So please do consider making a donation if you like my work, if you appreciate what I do, and if you want to see me continue to do that. Anyway, oh, also you can write to me at thefallofwesternman.com, mark at thefallofwesternman.com, and you can donate via crypto if you wish. Anyway, let's get in to the show tonight. Now, this isn't going to be a particularly contentious show. A lot of these shows that I do, I prepare them and I say, you know, listen to it all because it's going to be contentious, but there might be a point during the show where I reveal something or a conclusion that I come to that explains things. So don't watch the first 10 minutes, get all angry, turn it off for me to say something later that you might have approved of or come to a conclusion that you might not realize when I'm sort of discussing a complex topic and approaching it from a balanced point of view. This isn't that kind of stream, actually. So, you know, I suppose if you tap out on this one, you're not going to miss some conclusion that you didn't see coming. This case is absolutely horrific. And the body cam footage, I've watched that. Absolutely harrowing. Very, very, very upsetting indeed. Seeing a young boy pleading for his life as the police dismiss him in a mocking manner, handcuff him, and essentially leave him there to fall unconscious. The last words he ever spoke was essentially begging for his own life to police officers who were acting in such an appalling manner. But we've probably most of us have seen that now. We've read about the case. We know about the case. But when the case concluded, Henry Novak's killer, Vikram Digwa, was sentenced at Southampton Crown Court to life imprisonment with a period, a minimum period of 21 years. Now, it's very interesting that a lot of people don't actually know what that means. So let me explain. Vikram Digra, like anyone who's committed murder, gets a life sentence. Now, life in the UK means that they are sentenced to be locked up for the rest of their life. However, they can get paroled. And thus, judges set a minimum term which is attached to any life sentence, with one exception. The one exception is full life tariffs. There's only a very small number of people in this country who have ever committed crimes so serious that a judge has said, you have a full life tariff. You will spend the rest of your life in jail for what you did, and there will be no chance of parole. The vast majority of people, even if they commit acts of murder, get a what's called a minimum term applied. And the minimum term is the absolute minimum they will spend in jail. So Vikram Digwa was sentenced to life, to the rest of his life in jail, but he can be paroled after 21 years. What that means is he would have to sit in front of a parole board and he would have to plead his case. It is not an automatic release. So if you are, say, jailed for burglary, not that many people are jailed for that anymore, I believe, but let's say you were, and you were jailed for 2 years, you would now, under the new legislation passed by Labour, be eligible for automatic release after 40% of your time was served. That means at 40%, unless you've misbehaved in prison, you are automatically released. Vikram Digwa has no automatic release. When he gets to 21 years in jail, he would not be automatically released. That would be the earliest possible date a parole board could release him. And there's no guarantee he would be released at 21 years. That's the first thing to note, so we understand what this is. And if he was released at 21 years, he would still, because it was a life sentence, spend the rest of his life essentially serving that sentence outside of prison. So most of you will probably understand the Sam Melia case. Now, the Sam Melia case was one where Sam served 10 months of a 24-month sentence. So that was his 40%. He served 10 months. But after he was released, when the 10 months had expired, he served the rest of his sentence outside of prison. That means he was on ankle tag. He had to report to his parole officer, to his probation officer, and also to a load of other bodies because of the offence he committed. Now, because Vikram Digwa got a life sentence, the rest of his life he would be under a number of conditions. Some of them might involve him initially meeting a probation officer. That would be relaxed after a period of time. But if he was to commit another offence after being paroled, he could be immediately recalled to prison at any time in his life. Now, look, that's me explaining the law. So if people in the chat think that's wrong or don't like what I've said, there's not really much I can do about it because I can't change the law. That's just how the law works. But it's important to understand this before we go forward, because we want to understand what the minimum term means and what a life sentence means. And a lot of people say life should mean life. And there are life sentences that do mean life in the terms of life in jail. They're called full life tariffs. And technically, a life sentence is a life sentence because even if you are paroled, you are technically still eligible for immediate recall to jail if you commit another offence. As I say, I wanted to make that clear because I think it's important that we get things like that right so that we understand where we're working from. Now, let's read the sentencing remarks. These are from the judge. Now, it's also important to note before we read these that any sentencing remarks made by a judge are not just his opinions. Sentencing remarks are a strictly controlled legal document that is orally delivered to the court and then in most cases posted online afterwards or in the public domain for people to see what was said. These are not something that a judge just makes up. The judge has to follow strict guidelines laid out by the sentencing council. But what we'll see here is the problem in this case and the problem with this sentence wasn't the problem of one mad liberal judge who just, you know, lost it and came out with a bad judgment. This is actually a case. And the judge might be a liberal judge. I don't know him. I've actually not looked into him. I've been pretty, I've tried to be very fair in my assessment here. So he may be a liberal. But one thing is for sure, and one thing that you will find to be shocking here, is although this sentence was lenient, and you'll find out why it was lenient as we move through the sentencing remarks, the judge actually stuck to the sentencing guidelines. What the judge has done here is passed a sentence in line with the law. And this is the big problem. The problem isn't what a lot of MPs are saying, a couple of crooked liberal judges. The problem is actually much bigger. The problem is a system which is inherently broken. This system is not really broken. That's incorrect. These problems within the system aren't really problems. They're not bugs. They're actually a feature. The system has been created to result in this kind of outcome. This kind of outcome is a result of a system that has been manufactured to create this outcome. It is not a failing of the system. It's not a glitch. It is a feature. And this is why this isn't an issue of weeding out a couple of bad eggs, a couple of liberal judges. This is actually an issue of basically needing to sweep away the whole system because the problem is systemic. Anyway, here goes. This is the official document. It can be found online. I'm sure you can find it online. I obviously found it online. That's not me being glib. I mean, if you want to find it, you can. Obviously, we're going through it tonight, but it's very easy to find. His Honour, Judge William Mousley KC, Honorary Recorder of Southampton and Resident Judge. So he will likely be, I'm sure he is, the recorder in a particular Crown Court is the top judge in that Crown Court, which you would expect in a murder trial of this magnitude. The King v. Vikram Singh Digwa, sentencing remarks published on the 1st of this month, so the 1st of the 6th, 2026. I'll read them in full. Some of it won't require any explanation. Remember, this was orally delivered to a court, so when I read this, you can imagine a judge reading this to the courtroom. Stand up, please. And that is a judge's immediate directions to the person being sentenced. Henry Novak, aged 18, died on the 3rd of the 12th, 2025. He was a much-loved, kind, hard-working, ambitious young man devoted to his family and with a bright future. He was a first-year student at Southampton University, the first in his family to go to university. He was careful and principled, full of humour, warmth and promise. You, Vikram Digwa, murdered him. By doing so, you robbed him of all those he loved, all the things he cared about and liked to do. He would have been expected to live a long, hopeful, happy and fulfilling life. You have brought misery and a lifetime of loss upon his family and great sadness to everyone who knew him. You are 23 in December 2025. You were 22 and had no previous convictions. You may sit down for now. So there you have it. The intro is not really much to discuss. This is how you would expect any sentencing remarks to begin. Mark Novak, Henry's father, has described the devastating and lifelong impact of Henry's death on him and the whole family. He speaks of the horror of losing his son in such violent circumstances, the trauma of identifying his body, and the lasting torment of imagining Henry's final moments, which was thanks to the police as well. He describes overwhelming grief, guilt, helplessness, and the pain of seeing Henry's mother, siblings, and wider family broken by the loss. Mr. Novak says that the family has effectively been given a life sentence, with the pain affecting every aspect of their lives and every significant family occasion, and that nothing will ever fill the permanent void left by Henry's death. So this is the introduction, and obviously he's starting with the impact on the victim's family. Lucy Ross, Henry's mother, has described the profound and enduring impact of his death upon the whole family. She recalls the devastating moment she was told of his death and the anguish of having to tell Henry's elderly grandparents. She describes the continuing grief suffered by the family, including Henry's sister Olivia, who has not only lost her brother but her best friend, and says that the profound and lasting effect of this loss is something that they will carry for the rest of their lives. Olivia Novak, the sister of Henry, describes a relationship of exceptional closeness in which her brother was not only a sibling but her closest companion and a central part of her daily life. His death has, in her words, caused her world to fall apart. She recounts the profound shock and trauma of being informed of her brother's death and the continuing anguish associated with identifying him, attending his funeral, and confronting the many firsts without him, his birthday, Christmas, and other significant family occasions. The impact upon her own life has been profound and enduring. Her home, once a place of comfort, is now a constant reminder of his absence. She describes the effect on her ability to work due to persistent grief and intrusive thoughts about the circumstances of his death. She also carries an additional emotional burden as the eldest sibling, striving to support her younger brothers and sisters through their grief, whilst recognizing that she is powerless to remove their pain. This compounds her own suffering. The loss, she makes clear, is lifelong. Her life has been permanently changed by the death of her brother, and the emotional consequences remain acute and far-reaching. David Stevenson's stepfather describes the devastating impact of Henry's death upon him and the wider family. He explains that Henry was his much-loved stepson, with whom he had a close and affectionate relationship, and speaks of the shock of learning that Henry had been murdered and the lasting grief, sadness and anger that have followed. He also explains that the consequences have affected every aspect of his own life, including the loss of his employment, and says that the family will carry this pain permanently. Katie Woodcock, stepmother, describes the devastating and far-reaching impact of Henry's death upon her, her husband and the younger children in the family. She recounts the trauma of being told by police in the early hours that Henry had been stabbed and killed, and the lasting effect of that night upon her. She explains that the loss has caused profound emotional harm to Henry's younger siblings, including fear, anxiety, sleep disturbance, difficulties at school, and an enduring sense of insecurity. She also describes the strain upon family life, her own grief, fear, and inability to concentrate, and the pain of missing Henry in the ordinary moments of daily life. She says that the family continue to live with the permanent consequences of his death. So all that we've read so far, we don't really need to pass extensive comment on. This is the victim impact statements that allow the judge to essentially lay out how this has affected people. And this would obviously be taken into account when passing sentence, the suffering, the grief of the victim. And if the victim isn't there, the victims who are left behind, because this isn't just a case where Henry is the victim, his extended family, friends, they're also victims. Not long after 11 p.m. on the 3rd of the 12th, 2025, Henry Novak was walking back to his university accommodation in Portswood, Southampton, after an evening out. His route took him along Belmont Road, and he was approaching a junction with St. Denis Road, where you lived with your family. Henry was not drunk, but may have been affected a little by the small amount of alcohol he had consumed over the previous few hours. It's interesting that the judge has noted that, simply because he had a blood toxicology level beneath that which he would be allowed to drive. So very strange he brought that up. He was not a regular drinker and did not generally drink to excess. His blood alcohol level at the time of his death was below the legal limit for driving. The judges noted that. He was alone and unarmed. You happened to be walking south along Belmont Road on the same pavement. It was to be a chance meeting. So maybe I'm being a little bit harsh on the judge there, because he's laying out that although he'd had some drink, he certainly wasn't drunk. And I'm pleased he's noted that. He goes on. You were sober, but were carrying a large Sikh dagger in a sheath attached to a belt over the outside of your clothing. It is a strict requirement of the Sikh faith to have a knife called a kirpan at all times. Generally, this will be a small knife hidden from view, often on a length of cord and worn around the neck. You had that, but in addition, the large dagger in a sheath. You are a member of an order of Sikhs called the Nihang, who have a tradition of having a second knife or kirpan that is often fully visible. The press described this as a shastar. He's saying it's a larger kirpan, believing that the guru will look favorably on that. You observe that tradition in your everyday life, at work, and in public. Now, this is really important. So this guy, who is a killer, was essentially allowed to walk around at work, in his public life, wearing a giant dagger. I mean, it really is insane. And the judge then goes on to state this, and we're going to remember this. However, it was not a strict requirement. That is borne out by the fact that neither your brother nor father, who arrived on the scene after you had stabbed Henry, were so dressed. So what the judge is saying is Vikram Digwa wore not only the smaller knife beneath his clothes, but he also wore this giant dagger in a sheath on himself at all times. And one of his defenses was that he was allowed to carry this knife because it's a religious requirement. Yeah, his father and his brother didn't. So we're going to come back to this. According to Professor Gurnam Singh, professor of sociology and an expert in the field, over the last 30 years, there has been a trend towards younger people wearing a kirpan with pride in a desire to express their cultural identity. They see it as an act of resistance to being denied the ability otherwise to display their identity. Well, this to me sounds like total liberal trash already. I've never seen any ethnic minority denied the ability to express their identity in Britain. And the fact that younger Sikhs are increasingly wearing this deadly dagger in a sheath openly as they walk around the streets tells you everything you need to know. The privilege extended to practicing Sikhs of being allowed to be in public with a bladed article, and particularly in respect of a large dagger, a highly dangerous weapon, easily accessible to the wearer, brings with it huge responsibility. Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because it uses the word privilege. Now, the word privilege has become much maligned, but it's being used in its correct context here. Sikhs have a privilege not extended to other ethnic groups. It is a fundamental principle of Sikhism that any kirpan is worn as a symbol of religious faith. I mean, imagine that. A symbol of religious faith carrying a weapon at all times. And he's never to be carried for an offensive weapon. And here again, the judge is now in the excuse-making phase. The legal approach to the carrying of such a knife, as long as the blade length does not exceed 9 inches, is that an offence of having a bladed article in a public space will not be prosecuted. So the judge notes that it was legal for him to carry it. There has been an acceptance that its possession in those circumstances can amount to a good religious and therefore legal reason for having it. The blade of the knife will not be on display. Either it is under clothing or alternatively in a sheath, which it was. For both, it is a religious and consequently legal requirement that a kirpan should only be used offensively as a last resort, which would include its use in legal self-defense. In other words, only if necessary and, if so, reasonable in circumstances. It is obvious that for use to be reasonable, any perceived threat justifying its use would only be in circumstances of great seriousness and urgency. Now, I find this really, really interesting. And I find it interesting for a couple of reasons. One of those reasons is that essentially in this, in what we're reading here, the government understands that Sikhs may well use these as a weapon. And essentially this gives a Sikh a massive advantage if an opportunity arises where the Sikh may want to use it. It's absolutely crazy. But these three paragraphs that we've just gone through are absolutely key to where we're going with this particular case. And you can see the judge, he almost seems fawning in his discussion of these issues here. He seems almost as if he's fawning over the Sikh religion. You know, the guru looks kindly upon you, you wear the kirpan, it's a privilege. And this will come out later why he's labouring this point. In Belmont Road, you and Henry passed each other. You claimed he deliberately barged into you. I am sure that was one of the many lies you have told and repeated since it happened. However, there was an interaction between you both. Henry, perhaps cheekily, made a comment asking if you were a bad man. He was filming you on his phone when he said it. The tone of his voice was not aggressive or threatening, but as it turned out, a tragic error of judgment. It is a reasonable conclusion that the comment was because he had seen the large sheathed dagger. That would have been a very unusual thing for an 18-year-old student and non-Sikh to see. So this gives some sort of insight into how the incident occurred. You moved towards him and confidently told him that you were a bad man, and the underlining there was done by the judge, not me. This was a response, I believe, of somebody who thought they were being disrespected, made worse by the perceived intrusion of being filmed. You were not frightened or concerned and grabbed his phone, removing it from him. So the first act here, which is actually a criminal act, is he took his phone from him. Now, that, in effect, is a crime that he could also have been charged with, but he wasn't. He was only charged with two crimes, and this wasn't one of them. The exact events which immediately followed were only witnessed by Henry and you. However, it would not be unreasonable to conclude that Henry would have wanted his phone back, believing it had been stolen from him or that he had been robbed. Well, he had been robbed. That may have led to a physical struggle between you and him. In that situation, there was every need for self-restraint and control on your part. As someone who was born and raised in the UK, another one of these immigrants born here, that should have been your focus rather than any distorted view of your religious traditions. Strong words, even a verbal threat, might have been justified, but no more. It would also seem that your turban may have been knocked, pulled, or potentially punched off your head. The wearing of a turban at all times is another fundamental religious requirement of being a male Sikh. The removal of it by another would be considered a serious act and a further mark of disrespect. It is a reasonable conclusion that this would only have added to your anger. You can hear the judge's tone here, can't you? You drew the dagger from its sheath and, as the jury was sure, you deliberately stabbed Henry in the chest with it. The knife passed through several layers of clothing, as demonstrated by the multiple slits in his dark top where the material had been overlaid on itself in the struggle, and the single slit in his shirt. It passed upwards through soft tissue between the two uppermost ribs, catching a lung and cutting an important vein behind the collarbone. This was to a depth of 8 centimetres from the skin surface. The consequent bleeding flowed into his chest cavity. The pathologist, Amanda Jeffrey, found 1,200 millilitres, or over 2 pints of blood there. She said that no emergency medical treatment would have permitted access to the bleeding veins. In simple terms, he would not have survived, however quickly he received first aid, CPR, or expert medical treatment. So what they're saying here is he couldn't have lived. That's a medical expert. Medical experts are often contradicted by other medical experts, and I'm not sure if this is being said as a way to alleviate tension and take some degree of blame away from the police. You also stabbed him twice to the upper leg at some point and once again to the lower abdomen groin area at the front. The latter only resulted in a knife tip injury. The former were both to a substantial depth, although not as deep as the chest wound. Henry's face was also slashed with the blade of the dagger, but I cannot be sure that this was aimed or intended. However, one or more of the four stabs must have had an immediate effect, as Henry was never able to put up his hands to defend himself from further serious injury. He was defenceless. You, by contrast, had little, if any, injury. You told the attending police that you had a small bruise and swelling to your eye from a punch, but it was not obvious on body-worn footage taken then, and there has been no independent evidence given in the trial of any injury at all to you. Suggesting that he was basically uninjured and the talk of him being assaulted was a complete lie. And now this is a very interesting point because everyone knows his mother was involved in the case. But listen to this. Your brother, Gurpreet, arrived on the scene very shortly after your attack had finished. You then filmed Henry desperately trying to get away from you, somehow scaling a fence onto a communal bin before landing on a car in front of the property next door. Bloodstains show that he had got one, more, or all of his injuries before then. So not only did Vikram Digra stab him through the chest, he then stabbed him three more times as he was trying to escape, and then saw fit to film this happening with his brother also at the scene. So Henry must have been absolutely terrified at this point. He was outnumbered 2-1. He was being filmed. He was bleeding to death, and he had been stabbed four times and slashed once to the face. So this is far worse than what many media outlets and newspapers have actually reported. You then showed a callous disregard for his well-being. Knowing you had stabbed him to the chest, you continued to make films of Henry suffering, ignoring much of his desperation at having been stabbed. You told him that had not happened, no doubt to convince others who were nearby. Your attitude did not change, even though Henry was clearly going downhill very fast. Your brother did much the same, although he may just have been accepting that which you had told him rather than lying himself. I mean, this whole family just sounds like a monstrous group of bad eggs. You lied to him that you had been attacked, picking up on his question about whether it had been accompanied by racism, by falsely claiming that Henry had called you, and then they use the P word here that I can't use on stream. I am sure that Henry had said nothing racist. You're the only person to make that claim, and it is completely at odds with his previous character. So the only people to mention race at the scene were Vikram Digra and his family. You joined your brother in relating these lies to the police. By then, your mother and father were at the scene. Gurpreet explained that no weapons had been involved or were present. In fact, whilst he was talking to the call operator, you told your mother to take the murder weapon, sheath and belt away, which she did. You did not tell your father what had really happened. Much of the time, you just stood by as he, at least, tried to do something to help Henry. You carried on telling these wicked lies when police attended on the scene, hampering them in doing their job and effectively obstructing the course of justice. Again, he wasn't charged with that either. You kept Henry's phone with the incriminating recording of you on it. You had no intention of handing it over. It was found on you after you had been arrested and taken into police custody. Thereafter, the time came when the police needed permission from a court to extend the time for you to be questioned in custody and arranged for you and Gurpreet to be taken there for that purpose. They took the opportunity to record secretly any conversation between the two of you on the journey. Speaking in Punjabi, you agreed to pretend you had acted in self-defense, even though you confessed to stabbing Henry three times, including once to the chest with the dagger. You knew you were guilty, demonstrated by your saying to Gurpreet that if there were any cameras in that part of Belmont Road, you would be unable to put forward self-defense. You decided, much as you had at the scene, to try to cover it up. in all your police interviews, you decided not to answer questions about this incident. Instead, you made a written statement on the 7th of the 12th, 2025, which told more lies. Now, this is really interesting because this has only now just come out with the sentencing remarks. But Vikram Digwa and Gurpreet, when being taken to the police station, were speaking in their own native tongue so that they did not, or so they could not, be overheard by police officers or understood by police officers, but the police recorded those interactions and had an interpreter lay out what they actually said, which is very interesting. The level of deception here is incredible. Bear that in mind when we come to the final sentencing. I have to record the super chats when they come in. 2 seconds. There we go. Once the criminal proceedings were underway, you made another statement, developing and modifying those lies. It was only when you gave evidence in court that you put forward your full defense. The jury entirely rejected that defense, and I do too. In addition to killing Henry and the irreparable harm to those close to him, you have also caused real suffering to others who knew him. You have brought shame upon your family, your community, and your religion. Your actions have stirred up racial tension in Southampton and across the country, which have made many Sikhs worried about their own safety, even though they have done absolutely nothing wrong. Now, this is amazing, isn't it? So the first time the judge actually mentions race in any meaningful way here is the judge is worried about what people will think of Sikhs because of this. He isn't worried about how this has affected the white community, how white people might now fear Sikhs, and rightfully so, because they are armed on the streets. He's more worried that this will affect people's view of the Sikh community, and the Sikhs might be upset by that. Again, the priorities here seem very, very askew to me, very, very askew. You bear some responsibility for the offence committed by your mother when you asked her to take the murder weapon away from you after she arrived on the scene. Your lies to the police about what happened led, in part, to the arrests of your father, brother and mother for murder, and their being taken into police custody. Your mother has remained in custody for the past 7 months. So here, the family were involved. Now, from what we can tell, Gurpreet knew that he was lying. We don't know, and was there at the scene. We know his father was there at the scene. This suggests the father did at least in some way try to help Henry, but I never saw the father on the body cam footage explaining to the police that Henry had been stabbed, and the mother, well, she's up to her neck in it. Another consequence of those lies is that the attending police officers honestly believed that there were reasonable grounds for suspecting Henry had committed an offence and arrested him, with the consequence he was handcuffed for about a minute before his condition further deteriorated and the arresting officer began CPR. The police were given a convincing but wholly false narrative of the incident. And we're going to get to this later. You might have guessed this is something which is actually Conservative Party led, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. The police were given, oh, we've already read that, sorry. It was dark and Henry was wearing a dark top. The entry damage caused by the knife through it would not have been obvious. Whilst there was visible blood on Henry, it would not have been clearly seen coming from that wound, and the clearly visible facial wound was not life-threatening. Henry was complaining that he'd been stabbed and was struggling to breathe, but that would not have necessarily told the officers how serious the situation had become. A lot of excuses here for the police's action, in my opinion. It is the experience of the criminal courts that sometimes someone arrested and handcuffed will feign injury in the hope they may be released. These police officers were faced with having to make a quick decision in pressurised circumstances about the best way to act. Well, we know how they acted. They believed the non-white, because that's actually police policy, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The genuine shock to the particular police officer when he realised that he'd been giving CPR to Henry when he had a serious chest wound tends to show that he was doing his best in a very difficult situation. Again, more excuses for the police. This is how the system protects itself. You know, I hope you're getting a lot out of this, because I find this absolutely incredible. And you know, we're going to break this down more. It's going to be a long stream, but I think you can see where we're going with this. You were still present at the scene when Henry was saying he was dying, and still you did not tell the truth about how seriously you knew you had hurt him and the need for urgency. Instead, you said he had not been stabbed and that he was exaggerating. So we've heard everything here. We've heard both an overview of the crime, the victim impact statements from the mother, the father, the sister and the family. And now we've heard how the night unfolded. That's how sentencing remarks start. And sentencing remarks follow this strict pattern because they lay out everything that has been heard in court. So you can see how a judge came to the decision and how the trial unfolded and also the severity of the crime. So everything so far that we've gone through has been quite standard stuff. But there were some telling points in there, the almost fawning nature of the commentary over Sikhs being allowed to carry these knives. A lot of people would be shocked that these knives are so large and can be carried openly, you know, like as a dagger on a belt. All that's been covered. But there's also been quite a lot of commentary in here from the judge that sort of, I believe, is in there to wave away any guilt held by the arresting officers. And I believe there's a lot of guilt held by them. And we will come back to that later. Now we come to the actual sentencing. The sentence for murder is life imprisonment. Now, I told you that earlier, so the judge is confirming what I said. You will remain in prison for life unless the parole board decides that it is safe for you to be released on a life license. Again, that's what I said earlier. I must specify a minimum period to be served before the parole board may first consider earlier release. If you are released, you will be on license for the rest of your life and subject to recall to serve the rest of your life sentence. If a time does not come when the parole board is satisfied, it is safe to release you again. You would be liable to such recall if you committed any other offence or just broke any license conditions. So that part 29 there backs up everything I said earlier. I'm actually quite happy that's in there because it does validate the fact that I do know what I'm talking about when it comes to the criminal justice system. I've spent a lot of time reading about it, spent a lot of time learning about it, discussing things with legal professionals so I get these streams right. I have to apply Schedule 21 of the Sentencing Act 2020 to identify the starting point for that minimum period. This is where it becomes scandalous. In this case, that gives a minimum term, and it should say of 15 years, but it says is 15 years. That's a typo on the judge's behalf. The murder, and this is the crucial bit, the murder did not involve taking a knife to the scene with the purpose to use it to commit an offence or to have it available to do so. It is possible that you had a good legal, underlined, reason for having the dagger when you met Henry. Although, considering the jury's verdict, that reason must have come to an end after you removed it from its sheath. Neither was it murder for gain. Whilst you did take his phone or even rob him of it, that was neither the purpose of the murder nor clearly a part of it. But I'm sure it was a further trigger for what happened to Henry. Now, this is incredible because there are three minimum terms that can be applied. The lowest is 15 years, which basically says you were unarmed. The second is 25 years that says you went to the scene of the crime with a weapon. But he's been absolved of that because they've let him off on this because he's a Sikh. And the third is 30 years, which is if you commit a murder that is racially aggravated. Now, firstly, Vikram Digra, despite mentioning race at the scene, so we know that he had two things on his mind that night. One was killing Henry, and the second was race. They're the two things that happened. They were the two components of this crime, falsely talking about race, but also killing Henry Novak. So we know that race played a part in this murder, but he was never charged with a racially aggravated offence. And because he was never charged with a racially aggravated offence, he couldn't be sentenced to a 30-year minimum term. He should, in my humble opinion, have been sentenced to a 25-year minimum term. But that's also waived away. And that is waived away because he is a Sikh and because the judge has said he had good legal reason for having the dagger. There you go. But interestingly, the judge has said it is possible that you had a good legal reason. So this is incredible. The judge has given this Sikh murderer the benefit of the doubt based on an exception carved out for his religion, and thus has only started at the 15-year starting point. He goes on, there are a number of aggravating factors to increase the starting point. In no particular order, they are as follows. Firstly, you stabbed Henry three other times, then when inflicting the fatal wound, all with a highly dangerous weapon. Secondly, mental suffering was inflicted on Henry once he lay dying from his injuries by your attitude towards him, of which he would have been aware, and separately by your lies, which had resulted in a young adult of good character being arrested and handcuffed. Thirdly, there was additional degradation by filming his suffering. Fourth, your repeated and concerted actions after the event included attempts to cover up and conceal evidence had a tendency to pervert the course of justice. Again, he wasn't charged with perverting the course of justice, but he massively did. And he admitted to it. He admitted to perverting the course of justice in the police car. And he even admitted to it in Punjabi, so he thought he wouldn't be caught. He thought he had the perfect plan, but he wasn't charged with that. Fifth, you wrongly placed blame on Henry, and your lies also led to unnecessary arrests for members of your family. Sympathy for his family, which would not have happened if you had told the truth. Sixth, you prevailed upon your mother to assist your attempts to pervert the course of justice. Seventh, Henry was only 18 and armed and alone, which made him additionally vulnerable. Eighth, the offence has had a significant community impact upon others, as described and evidenced in press reporting and social media reaction. Ninth, your lies misled the attending officers, which influenced their decision not only to arrest Henry and handcuff Henry, but also to give subsequent emergency first aid in ignorance of the fact that he had a serious chest wound. Lastly, you abused the privilege extended to Sikhs to have a knife in a public place for religious reasons, dishonoured your religion. This is an aggravating factor that he dishonoured his religion, and now have put others at risk of repercussions. Again, sympathy for the Sikh community. These factors increase the minimum term to 23 years. So now the minimum term rises to 23 years. A number of these would not have applied if you had told the police what you said to your brother in the police van on the 5th of the 12th, 2025. The mitigating factors reduce that minimum period to 21 years. They are your age, previous good record with no previous convictions, and a lack of premeditation. There are no others. I am sure you intended to kill in the moments before you stabbed Henry. This is incredible, because we've already said that the minimum sentence, the starting point, the minimum term that he would serve in jail, the starting point, was 15 years because he was a Sikh. But that also applies here. He's saying there's no premeditation. Now, if you were walking down the street with a giant blade as a white man, or even as a black man, you know, walking down the street with this giant blade, and then you stabbed somebody, they would argue that the act of carrying the knife to the crime scene was premeditation, but they're saying it's not premeditation because he possibly had a good legal reason to carry the blade. Incredible. I must also deduct the period you have already spent in custody since first appearing in court after you were charged on the 8th of the 12th, 2025. I calculate that to be 175 days before today. So this is how they calculate the 21-year minimum period. Stand up, Vikram Digwa. The sentence on count one is life imprisonment with a minimum of 20 years and 190 days before there can be any consideration given to whether you can be safely released before the end of your life. On count two, the sentence is 2 years imprisonment concurrent to count one. That's for the possession of the bladed weapon, which only became chargeable once he drew it from his sheath. So, I mean, you know, you can carry it down the street in its sheath, but the moment he popped it out, that's when it became a deadly weapon, as far as the court is concerned, which is insane and allows him to escape the aggravating factor of premeditation. Can you see how unfair this is? And he's sentenced formally to 20 years and 190 days, but he's already served 175, so that is your 21 years. Finally, part 35, if there was a surcharge payable, the order will be drawn up in the appropriate amount. So there you have it. Page 10 of 10, we have concluded. Now, let's get this straight. I think the important things to take away from this is, firstly, Vikram Digwa was never charged with a racially aggravated crime. That reduces sentence immediately. Secondly, because he was a Sikh, he was not subject to the 25-year minimum term, which anyone who was not a Sikh would have been subject to. And that's because the judge said he possibly had a good legal reason for carrying the blade, because he was allowed to carry it as long as it remained in its sheath. And because of that, he also escaped the aggravating factor of premeditation. This is why Vikram Digwa ended up with what the press and certain MPs, to their credit, are saying is a very lenient sentence. And this lenient sentence is because, not because of some liberal judge, it's not because the judge didn't follow sentencing guidelines, it's not because the judge didn't follow relevant legislation. This is because the judge was totally entitled to pass this sentence, and every part of this sentence, whether you like it or not, and I don't like it, every part of this sentence is actually done lawfully and within relevant legislation and within sentencing guidelines. And this is what I said earlier. This isn't about one liberal judge. This is about a systemic problem. This is a system-wide failure. But it's not a failure because the system was designed to achieve this kind of outcome. And I'm going to tell you now something. And this is what legislation the judge is citing. So in the Criminal Justice Act 1988, can everyone remember that? This is going to be like a school lesson now. I want you all sit down and remember two dates for me. The first, 1988, remember that. The Criminal Justice Act 1988 grants an exception for Sikhs carrying a ceremonial knife in section 139, subsection 5, paragraph B. Under subsection 139, it is generally an offence to carry a bladed or sharply pointed article in a public place. However, this statute outlines a specific statutory defence for religious reasons, and it reads as this: it shall be a defence for a person charged with an offence under this section to prove that he had the article with him for religious reasons. Application to Sikhs. There you go. Now, the second piece of legislation is the Offensive Weapons Act 2019. So, remember the first date. Do you remember the first date? Remember the second date now, 2019. Remember this, and I'm going to ask you a question in a second. Section 47 of the Offensive Weapons Act 2019 explicitly grants exceptions and legal defences for Sikhs regarding the possession, supply and presentation of certain traditional weapons, such as curved swords. Key legal provisions under Section 47, possession for religious reasons, Section 47.1. Amends Section 141 of the Criminal Justice Act 1988. It provides a statutory defence for a person to show they possessed a large curved sword for religious reasons only. Section 47.2 and 47.3 create specific defences for importing, making available or giving a curved sword to another person, provided the conduct was for the purpose only of making the sword available for presentation by a Sikh to another person at a religious ceremony or other ceremonial event. Section 47.4 explicitly defines a Sikh as a follower of the Sikh religion. And that is to clarify who qualifies for these legal protections. So this is anti-white, because we wouldn't benefit from this. This is for Sikhs. But I asked you a couple of questions, and I asked you for them for a reason. I'm going to bring up the chats now to see if anyone gets this right. So the two dates, 1988 and 2019, which party was in power in 1988 and 2019? Which power? Which party was in power? What was the government, or who made up the government in 1988 and in 2019? We've got a winner over on one of the chats. We've got Albion Lost. He's named the, he said the Tories, and he's correct. And the winner in the other chat is Rockwell1488 Pierce, who said Tory, but he gets a, sorry, mate, you get a minus point because you misspelt it. But that's correct. These guys are the winners. It was the Conservatives. In both cases, in 1988 and in 2019, the party responsible for carving out these exceptions that allowed Vikram Digwa to carry those knives was the Conservative Party. Not Labour, the Conservatives. And we're building a case here tonight because the next thing we're going to discuss, and remember, we're just getting started here, guys. We're just getting started. So let's bring up the next thing that we wish to discuss tonight, because there is more. The first part of the stream was called Lenient Sentencing, and the second part was Badenoch's BS. And that's what we're going on to next, guys. We're going on to Badenoch's BS. And this appeared in the Daily Mail the other day. Henry's family fury. Henry Novak's family want common sense policing to bring society together, says Kemi Badenoch, as murdered teen's parents leave Downing Street following meeting with Keir Starmer. Well, I can't read it here because it's locked, but I have got one of those funky. Pages which allows you to unlock an article, and we're going to unlock this article because it's very important that we do that. So here we go. This unlocks it for free because I'm not paying for it. Haha, there you go. Tough. I'm not spending my money supporting people who have attacked me and called me everything under the sun. Kemi Badenoch meets Henry Novak's family, saying they want common sense policing to bring society together, with PM due to hold talks in Number 10 later. Now, this is pretty, you know, she wants Henry's memory to bring society together instead of tearing communities apart. She's going all out, is Kemi Badenoch. But this is the interesting thing. And we're going to go down. It's a regular article. But here's a tweet by Kemi Badenoch. And this is what I wanted to actually read to you. Kemi Badenoch said, "Today I've met Lucy, Mark and Katie, Henry Novak's mother, father and stepmother. Their courage is extraordinary. They have endured the most appalling loss. It is a life sentence for them." So she's really going out here, making out she's batting for these people. "They have also faced the agonizing decision to release the harrowing body-worn camera footage, knowing how painful it would be and how strongly people would react. They did so because they want truth, accountability and change. They have asked that we work across political parties and religions to rebuild trust in the police. That trust has been broken because of what happened, and I agree with them on that. We must also be prepared to examine carefully and seriously religious practices or exemptions that permit the carrying of dangerous weapons in public and other activities that are not conducive to the public good. We also need to examine where the law needs to change. Henry's family do not want anger to tear communities apart. They are a family who have friends across faith and race, and so did Henry. His family wants his memory to bring our society together." She keeps saying that, doesn't she? "Everyone knows I have strong views about how we should deal with equality under the law. What the family agreed with me on is that we need to bring common sense back, and that is what we should all be fighting for. I promise the family we will work to ensure there is a positive legacy for Henry out of this tragedy. That is my focus now." Well, guys, do we think she's telling the truth? You see, this is interesting because she clearly said we need to look at practices or exemptions that commit the carrying of dangerous weapons in public. Well, one of those exemptions came from legislation passed in 1988, but it was the Conservative Party her party that passed that legislation. So I can blame her for being in the Conservative Party, but I can't blame her personally because she was not part of that government. The other part of that legislation came in 2019 when she absolutely was in the Conservative Party, when she was an MP, and she did nothing about it. And we can see where we're going here. But this isn't the only part of this, which is interesting. You see, there is another issue. This took place, this horrific crime took place in Southampton. Southampton is part of the Hampshire and Isle of Wight constabulary. That is a constabulary which is under the control of a woman called Donna Jones, who is the elected police commissioner. She is a Conservative. And upon that constabulary, she forced a new police strategy called the Police Race Action Plan, improving policing for black people. And it was this Police Race Action Plan which made it so that police officers must always act in a way that is anti-racist. In other words, it is the Police Race Action Plan that lays out that police must always take the side of the person crying racism. It is the Police Race Action Plan, which is the specific police strategy implemented at grassroots level within the police, at frontline level, that informs officers that they must always take accusations of racism seriously and act in an anti-racist way. That is why the police immediately arrested Henry Novak on Vikram Digwa's say-so. That was forced upon those police officers by a Conservative police commissioner. And the Police Race Action Plan was drawn up and implemented, drum roll, in 2022 by the same Conservative government that Kemi Badenoch was part of, and the same Conservative government that carved out the exception for curved swords in the 2019 legislation. Do you see where we're going here? Every piece of legislation or every piece of guidance that led not only to Henry Novak's death, but led to lenient sentencing for his killer, is a product of the Conservative Party. And we're going to have a quick look at it, because you didn't think we were going to end there, did you? We now can have a look at the Police Race Action Plan. So the Police Race Action Plan, here we go, all the bump at the beginning. We're not going through the whole thing. It's 57 pages, but you can be sure that I am going to go through it and do a big Substack article on it, which will be up on Tuesday. So look forward to that. There's many sections. Overview. There's all these appendices, which we wouldn't look at anyway. But here's the most important bit. Building an anti-racist police service. So here's the foreword written by these two absolute smug anti-white race traitors. Remember those guys? And here's a quote. The collective failure of an organization to provide an appropriate and professional service to people because of their color, culture, or ethnic origin, it can be seen or detected in processes, attitudes, and behavior, which amounts to discrimination through unwitting prejudice, ignorance, thoughtlessness, and racial stereotyping. Boom! That's exactly what happened to Henry Novak. That's exactly what happened to Henry Novak. The collective failure of an organization to provide an appropriate and professional service to people because of their color, culture, or ethnic origin. He was denied appropriate medical care because he was white. This document aimed to do away with racism and instead instituted a system of anti-white racism. Yeah. This is all the intro. They're their signatures. They signed off on this. Development and scrutiny of the plan, the Police Race Action Plan, the plan, has been developed jointly by the National Police Chiefs Council and the College of Policing, with input from stakeholders, including the National Black Police Association, the Independent Scrutiny and Oversight Board, the Chair and Association of Police and Crime Commissioners. Some of the activity in the plan is already underway. Over the next 6 months, there'll be wider engagement with stakeholders and communities to test and refine the actions. At the same time, the ISOB, chaired by Barrister Abimbola Johnson, that's a good English name, will scrutinise the plan and the approach to delivery. Work will also be undertaken to determine timeframes for delivery of the actions. All the people involved in this helped humiliate a dying white boy. The case for change. Our vision is for a police service that is anti-racist and trusted by black people. Not a police service that serves everyone, not colorblind. Because remember, when all this started, it was about being colorblind, wasn't it? When all this started, it was about creating a world where the police didn't see color, they treated everyone equally. Now, it's about creating a police force that is the opposite of colorblind, that it's anti-racist and trusted by black people. Why not trusted by everybody? Why not trusted by white people? Why not trusted by everyone that lives in Britain who wants fair policing? No, it's about being trusted by black people. The legitimacy and effectiveness of UK policing is built on relationships between the police and the public. Well, yeah, white people can't stand police anymore because you arrest dying white boys and cover up the rape of white girls. But there are long-standing challenges in our relationship with black communities, not mentioning all the horrible things they've done to white communities. God. Without the trust and confidence of black communities, policing is less effective at protecting all communities. I mean, whoever wrote this really, really, you know, thought they'd got some zingers here, didn't they? Although much has been done over the years to tackle racism, discrimination and bias in policing, change has not been fast enough nor significant enough. Now, this is the best bit so far. It gets worse. Black people are 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white people. Why? And 5 times more likely to be subject to the use of force. Why? Testimonies tell us black people find these encounters, particularly stop and search, confrontational, stigmatizing and humiliating. This is amazing because this is actually one of the things Theresa May did. Theresa May's actions have actually led to lots of young black men dying. There used to be stop and search. She stopped stop and search because it primarily resulted in black people being arrested. So when stop and search took place over London or throughout London, they would stop white gangs, found they were unarmed, let them go. They would stop black gangs, find out they were heavily armed and arrest them. That led to this disparity where blacks were more likely to be arrested. Theresa May said, we don't want this disparity. She stopped stop and search. She's a vile hag. I despise her. She's one of those people that I am so pleased she isn't having children and that her seed will be wiped from the earth. She has been nothing but a cancer on UK politics. She stopped stop and search. And all of a sudden, young black men are dying again because it's better for people to die on the streets than it is for their killers to be arrested if their killers would be black. This is the logic of these people. And what I'm saying here is some of this legislation does hurt white people, but it also hurts black people as well, because some of it amounts to burying your head in the sand and letting a problem get worse. We'll skip through this bit here. Focus on black communities and people. Policing recognises that racial disparities affecting black people are most acute, and the trust deficit presents a significant challenge to police legitimacy and effectiveness. This plan, therefore, focuses on improving policing for black people. So this isn't about making it fair. This isn't about doing this for everyone. This is all about black people. But when they say black, we'll see what they mean. When we say black people, we mean black African, black British, black Caribbean, black other, and mixed black backgrounds. So basically, they mean a lot of people, but we're not going to stop there, guys. Let's not end there. Disparities also exist in policing's relationship with other ethnic minorities, including the UK's Asian communities and Gypsy, Roma and Traveller communities. We do not intend to minimise these issues. The plan is in addition to ongoing efforts to ensure that policing is inclusive and fair to all, and that concerns from minority or underrepresented groups are acted on. So basically, this whole document is help everybody at the expense of white people, which is what we saw on the night of Henry Novak's murder. Black people have significantly lower than average rates of confidence in the police force at 64% compared with an average of 74%. Among Black Caribbean people, the rate is just 54%. Asian people, meanwhile, have higher than average rates of confidence in the police force at 77%. Yes, that's because the police force refused to arrest any of the men in the grooming scandal. So they knew, you know, obviously, we in this country refer to the Pakistani Muslims as Asian. The Asians knew that they could do what they want and get away with it. Why wouldn't they be confident in policing? And it goes through some of these supposed disparities. Our vision is for a police service that is anti-racist and trusted by black people. The police, the plan seeks to create an anti-racist culture, not a fair culture, but an anti-racist culture. Values and behaviours within policing. This will inform all, this is the key bit, so I'm going to read this very seriously now. The plan seeks to create an anti-racist culture, values and behaviours within policing. This will inform all operational policing practice, improving the experience and outcomes for black people. It will enable the experiences of our black communities, officers and staff to have a direct influence on our policies and practices going forward. And that is where you have it, folks. The plan seeks to create an anti-racist culture, values and behaviours within police or policing. This will inform all operational policing practice. And it did. You can see how this affected officers on the night of the incident. And for some reason, and quite annoyingly, they then changed the orientation of the page. That's irritating. An anti-racist police service, the outcomes we are seeking to achieve. Making sure black people feel and are safer. Reducing black victimization, especially of hate crime and serious youth violence. Reducing the harm caused by crime and disorder experienced by black people. Treating black victims and witnesses better. Understanding their needs and vulnerabilities. Improving the quality and outcome of our investigations for black victims. Improving how we prevent and respond to the crime and disorder concerns of the black communities, particularly young people. Helping black communities to address local crime and disorder, actively supporting services that make a difference to young black people's lives. Not over-policed, a police service that is fair, respectful and equitable in its actions towards black people, eliminating any racial bias, stereotyping, profiling or discrimination in our actions, treating black people as individuals and taking account of their needs, vulnerabilities, experiences and the circumstances such as trauma. Approaching racial disparities in our actions as problems in themselves, regardless of their causes, because of their impact on black people. Minimizing any harms we inadvertently cause because of their differential impact on black people. Reducing the risk of criminalizing black people by ensuring they benefit from early action, prevention, and diversion. And this is all about involvement and representation. Summary of the plan. And we're coming to the end of the bit I'm going to read. Our commitments, zero tolerance of racism in policing. At a personal and interpersonal level. At a force level. At a national level. Policing will adopt an explain or reform approach to address the negative impact and outcomes experienced by black people. Policing will ensure that officers and staff understand the history of policing black people and the ongoing impact and trauma of disproportionality. The development of a representative workforce. I'll explain that one briefly. They want there to be lots more black people in the police force regardless. Policing will increase the involvement of black communities in its work and improve support to black victims of crime. Summary of the actions we will take. Increasing the awareness and understanding of every officer and every member of staff of racism, anti-racism, black history and its connection to policing. Improving the recruitment, retention and progression of black people within policing. Improving understanding of addressing workplace disparities and the experience of black officers. Whew. Reducing racial disparities in misconduct and complaints processes and improving support to black officers and staff. Development of a new national approach to help forces identify and tackle racial disparities in the use of powers. The use of a new national approach to improve and promote consistency in recording, analysis and monitoring. Proposals to strengthen government and oversight of the use of police powers. Improving the knowledge and skills of all officers in a range of powers. Now, this is a long document, and I'm going to go through this and prepare an article about this and do an analysis. There's probably too much to go through here tonight. We'd be here all night, but you can see how this document, this insidious document, has been used to change the way that frontline officers act. Frontline officers now behave in a completely different manner to how they used to. And key to this, the actual key to this, is fundamentally that officers who have had this document have a commitment to zero tolerance of racism, and they have to be anti-racist in everything that they do. And I am absolutely sure that the officers attending the scene of Henry Novak's murder were doing their best to follow that document. That document was put into practice by the Conservative Party nationally in 2022, and it was forced upon the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary by Donna Jones, who is the current serving police commissioner for that constabulary, who is also a Conservative. In short, there was lenient sentencing. The judge clearly made every effort through legal means and by sticking to sentencing guidelines to reduce Vikram Digwa's minimum term as much as he could. And he did so legally using legislation passed by the Conservative Party. Two generations of Conservative governance. 1988, which I believe would have been Thatcher, and 2019, which I believe would have been Boris Johnson. Then we went on to Kemi Badenoch. She's trying to make hay on this. She's trying to be the strong Conservative leader who wants to change things. Well, firstly, it was her party that started the ball rolling in 1988. It was the party that she was part of, and she was a sitting MP for, that continued the ball rolling in 2019. And this colourblind policing, this sensible policing that she's calling for, was something that the Conservative Party did their best to abolish. The officer's behaviour was in line with a document pushed on police forces, a strategy enacted by a Conservative government. And what's more, even now, when the Conservatives aren't in government, it is a Conservative police commissioner who is underneath Badenoch in the party hierarchy, who instituted this and made sure this was followed in her constabulary. This tells you everything you need to know. The Labour Party are undoubtedly scum, but there are many people, especially those in populist parties, people, and this isn't to have a go at either Reform or Restore, but in parties like Reform, in parties like Restore, who absolutely think that the Conservative Party is some kind of ally. I have proved tonight, beyond a shadow of all doubt, that this is not the action of a couple of rogue liberal judges. This is something which is being done on an institutional, systemic level, and it involves every part of the English criminal justice system. And the legislation at blame in this particular case is all thanks to the Conservative Party. The Conservatives are not your friend. Kemi Badenoch is misleading the public, and she's getting away with it because the newspapers, like the Daily Mail, where we read that article, are absolutely 100% not doing their due diligence and exposing what she's saying. Someone needs to walk up to that woman in public and say, you're talking about colorblind policing. You're talking about a white boy stabbed to death with a Sikh dagger. But it was your party that passed the legislation that allowed him to carry that dagger. It was your party that tried to create anti-racist police forces that had to be anti-racist in everything they did and informed frontline officers that on the allegation of racism, that immediately that could not be challenged. And that's the point. Police officers are not allowed to challenge the perception of racism. So if someone at the crime scene says this was racist, this was motivated by a racial animus, the police officers are to listen, to understand, but not to challenge. And they're not to challenge because that means if they do, they are not taking into account the lived experiences of minorities. This is why we're in a mess. We're not in a mess because of a couple of bad eggs. We're in a mess because of systemic, two-tier, anti-white justice that is baked into every level of the system, not by accident, but by design. And much of this has been done by the Conservative Party. Do not believe them. Do not vote for them. They are your enemy just as much as Labour. And Badenoch is hiding the truth. She's not directly lying, but she is lying by omission. She is not part of the solution. She damn well was and is part of the problem. It was Conservative Party policy that played a massive role in the killing of Henry Novak. That's all I have to say for tonight. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope this has been something that you've got something out of. It's been quite laborious at times. We've gone through everything with a fine-tooth comb, other than the large document. We skimmed that because it's 57 pages and we'd already read 10 pages of another document. And I've been doing this for nearly 90 minutes now. And after a while, soloing it for that length, especially with this level of information, it does get a bit tiring. But I hope you have enjoyed it. We're going to do the super chats. If you haven't super chatted and you want to do that now, I will answer the question or any questions that are sent in. And I'll do that now. Don't mind me, 91 gave $50. Thank you so much. And said, what happened to War Strike? They went their own separate ways. I think it's really good that Warren is now doing his own thing. I'm really looking forward to Warren's future content. Warren is a really good friend of mine. And, you know, I really, really hope he keeps knocking it out of the park and goes in what I feel is a better direction for him. There isn't going to be any more War Strike. So that's that. And as I said, hopefully I'll be able to get Warren back on PWR now and I'll continue to work with him. I speak to him regularly and I think he's going to be much better producing the kind of content he wants to. I know there was, you know, a couple of sort of heated exchanges on episodes running up to the end of the run. But yeah, I really hope Warren keeps knocking it out of the park and goes down the route that he wants to. So yeah, that's good. That's good. And I wish him obviously all of the best in that. UK Rob M gave $25. Thank you so much. And he said, hi, Mark. Thanks for this. It's a terrible case. Well, I'm really pleased you enjoyed the stream. I've noticed a lot of people in the chat tonight saying thank you thank you so much for doing this. And people seem to really like what's being said. Hazelnut 3000 gave $10. Thank you so much. And just said, thanks, Mark. Well, thank you. And thank you for your continued support. I'm pleased people have got a lot out of this tonight. Obviously, there's quite a lot of research went into it. So I really like it if people have enjoyed it. And you guys seem to have. So thank you so much to everyone. Anyway, I'm going to call it a night now. I will be back on Sunday with the Nationalist A team. It'll be a good stream. Me, Natty, Sam and Patriarch. Looking forward to that. And also go and check out my Substack. It's pinned in the comments. I've got a great article about this. Look, not many people are going to watch a 90-minute stream, but people will read an article. Go check out the article. Go enjoy it. Share it with your family and friends. Sub me over there. Help me out if you can. It's only $10 a month to support me there. A lot of people prefer to give in that way. And if you can, I would be very, very thankful to anyone who does that. There's a new article out twice a week, and they are all big, hard-hitting, heavy-duty articles. You get more than the value for your money for those kind of articles. Obviously, if you're paying $10 a month, you're getting, you know, 8 to 10 sort of 4 to 5,000 word articles every month. Oh, everyone can get them. They're free for anyone to read, but it does support the work, and I think the articles are worth it. It's this sort of level of analysis, but in article format that can be shared more easily. Anyway, if you are out at protests at the weekend, please behave yourselves. I don't want to hear of anyone kicking off with police, throwing things at the police, getting themselves arrested. That doesn't help our cause. It doesn't help Henry Novak. It allows us to be demonized. Don't play into their hands. They are anti-white, and they will treat you very differently to how they would treat Black Lives Matter or any other non-white group. We know that, and we can prove that because of the document I've just read to you. So please, please stay within the law. Behave yourselves. Be respectful to police officers, other members of the public, and anyone else in the area, people on working on public transport, etc. Be respectful, put our best foot forward and keep it clean, guys. I want to see you all soon at future upcoming PR events, such as our camp and conference. I don't want you in jail. That would be awful. But thank you so much. Hope you have a wonderful evening. I look forward to seeing you again, either Nationalist A-Team on Sunday or Patriotic Weekly Review next week. Go and check out the Substack. Thanks again, everyone, and to all those who donated so generously. And finally, thank you to everyone who tuned in, shared the stream, and enjoyed it with me. Good night.